Okay, our first argument this morning for this panel is Daria Harper, an individual, and Daniel Winiger, an individual, versus Copper Point Mutual Insurance et al., case 82158. Council, ready to proceed?
Yes.
Okay, so let's get started. Mr. Mayor, I see you. Mr. Bloomberg, I understand.
John Blumberg, appearing for the appellants. If it please the court, good morning, justices. I would like to address three issues in my argument, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mm-hmm. The three issues that I would like to address are, first, how NRS 42.021 should be interpreted, because that was the issue that formed the basis of the district court's decision. Second, how different states attempt to balance their individual medical malpractice laws. And number three, why Nevada's medical malpractice law should take precedence over Arizona's medical malpractice law. Dealing with the first issue, of how to interpret the statute. This was a statute enacted by initiative. And as this court said in Peruzzi versus 8th Judicial District, when there is no legislative intent, to determine the intent of the voters, one must look to the ballot description and the arguments of the proponents. So when this proposed statute was on the ballot, it was described as prohibiting third parties who provided benefits as a result of medical malpractice from recovering such benefits from a negligent provider of health care. And the Secretary of State's description of the initiative was largely similar to that. Neither the ballot description nor the explanation by the Secretary of State mentioned anything about whether there had to be evidence produced at a trial as opposed to a settlement. This makes some sense if we look at the fact that the statute, the proposed statute, was virtually identical to the California statute. And at the time of the initiative, the Supreme Court in California and the California Court of Appeal, in separate opinions, had interpreted that statute as applying to preclude a lien or credit by the source of collateral benefits if there's a settlement, as well as there is evidence at trial. So at the time of the initiative, it was presented as the same law of California, but that law had already been interpreted to apply to settlements, which I suppose makes sense that the Secretary of State did not differentiate between settlements and judgments. And for that reason, it had previously been interpreted by the highest court of the state where the law was, I'm not sure if the word is borrowed, but where the source of that law was. Number two, how it was described. So the intent of the voters was that there is no differentiation, that when there is a conclusion and a payment of money, the source of collateral benefits has no lien rights, no subrogation rights. The second issue that I would like to address has to do with the balance that different states use in their medical malpractice laws.
Let me, if I might interrupt you, let me go back to your first argument for a moment. Setting aside whatever California decided in interpreting their statutes, on the plain language of this statute, what's the purpose of having language that talks about introducing things into evidence if not for the fact that it deals with not settlements, but a jury trying to assess damages in a case?
That is a question that I keep asking myself, why the proponents, which was not a legislature, it was an interest group, why they took the exact language from the California statute and said, we want that too, after there had already been a determination interpreting that statute that it does not apply to, that it does apply to settlements as well and has to be read that way. Why did this language end up? I don't have anything other than a speculative explanation. And one is that the proponents said, well, this is the statute in California which originated these limitations in the first place in 1975. And they said, well, what's good enough for them is good enough for us. And then did not do the research to see how it had been interpreted. But that's speculation. And I have no better explanation than anyone else how it ended up that way. It, all we know is that it did end up that way.
Okay.
Thank you. The second issue that I would like to address has to do with the balance that every individual state uses in its medical malpractice laws. In Nevada, there is a balance that says that non-economic damages above $350,000 may not be received by a plaintiff in a medical malpractice case. That limitation then is balanced with 42.021, which says that no source of collateral benefits will have a lien or the right to subrogation. That is Nevada's balance. Other states have different balance, have different balances. In California, the limit is $250,000, not $350,000. In Arizona, its constitution says that there shall be no limitation on damages. And so in Arizona, the Arizona balance is there are no medical malpractice caps on non-economic damages. But under the medical malpractice statute of Arizona, workers' compensation insurance companies have the right to subrogate and have a right to a lien. That is Arizona's balance. So what we have where there are two different states who find their own balances, we have the respondent, Copper Point, who says that even though the law of Nevada that has its own balance and which restricted the plaintiff to no more than $350,000 in non-economic damages, the respondent says, we want to import something from Arizona because under Arizona law, we get to have a lien. So what Copper Point is advocating is a very interesting mix and match. That is, taking the position that it doesn't matter what the Arizona balance is, it doesn't matter what the Nevada balance is, they can have it both ways. They can come into a Nevada court and say, we are not governed by Nevada laws and limitations because we have rights in Arizona. And it's true, they have rights in Arizona under that balance. But the appellant, Daria Harper, didn't have the right to file her lawsuit in Arizona where there would be no limitations on non-economic damages, she was required to file her lawsuit against the Nevada defendants in Nevada and be subject to Nevada's limitations, but also have the benefit of Nevada's preclusion on collateral sources. Had she been able to try the case in or file and prosecute the case in Arizona, she would have had unlimited non-economic damages, and Copper Point would have the absolute right to a lien or subrogation. But what we have here is a hybrid, and the hybrid is a mix and match, which is never going to work because it unbalances the carefully constructed laws of different jurisdictions. And because this jurisdiction limited the recovery and limited the rights of workers' compensation insurance companies, that balance needs to be honored and not subject to importing the law of another state, which creates an injustice, because it's one thing to limit a plaintiff's ability to recover non-economic damages, but then to impose the right of the workers' compensation insurance company to further affect her rights is simply unfair.
So I have one question for you. If we agree with your argument, your first argument, why should this court become involved in interpreting the workers' compensation subrogation law in Arizona? And why does your complaint seek to require continued payments from the Arizona compensation system when Nevada really has no business addressing that? I don't get it.
Let me answer the question this way. The lawsuit was prosecuted in Nevada, subject to Nevada law. And under Nevada law, if it is interpreted as we advocate with regard to applying to settlements, it says that no collateral source shall have the right to a lien or credit rights. That's the law of Nevada. That was the jurisdiction where the settlement took place in light of what Nevada's law was. And so I believe that it is the business and concern of the Nevada courts to enforce its laws, because its laws say that there is no right to a lien.
Well, assuming that that's the declaration of this court, then I don't see why we're also involved in entering orders compelling Copper Point to continue to pay workers' compensation benefits when that's an issue that involves the claimant and the insurance company in Arizona. So why did you add that portion to your complaint? I get the point that lawyers need to do what they need to do on behalf of their clients, but I don't understand how this court or Nevada can afford that kind of affirmative relief.
Well,
declaring the issue about the right to recover against the Nevada settlement is one issue to me. But affirmatively compelling the workers' compensation system or carrier in Arizona to maintain its coverage and its benefits to your client is another.
Justice Hardesty, I appreciate the question, but
you're welcome.
No, it's an excellent question, not addressed in the briefs.
Yeah.
How else? And this isn't fair. I'm asking you a question, but I'm posing it rhetorically. How else do you prevent an out-of-state workers' compensation insurance company from abiding by the laws imposed in the manner. If there is
but
not
I can't declaration. Give you legal advice, but it would seem to me that it would be awfully difficult for a foreign jurisdiction insurance company or a foreign jurisdiction entity to pursue a claim against an asset that doesn't belong to your client. It's not much different than an exemption that exists under the statutes for debt collection. I mean, if this court were to declare that this is not a recoverable asset against which subrogation can be maintained, and that's a question I have for your opponents, how do you get there?
If this
doesn't the question begin and end with an answer to how we interpret this statute?
It depends on how this court perceives what issues are before it. If the primary issue, or issue number one, is how do we interpret the statute for all parties prosecuting medical malpractice cases in Nevada? Does it apply to settlements, or does it apply only if there is evidence at mm-hmm. trial? That is one issue, because this is a matter of first impression.
What other issue is there?
Well,
the issue of the affirmative relief question, although raised in your complaint, doesn't seem to have been briefed here, and I'm not sure that it's even before us, but I think that it's an issue that's still out there.
It only arises out of a conflict of laws analysis, and that is if there is a conflict between the law of Arizona that says they're entitled to a lien and the law of Nevada that says they're not entitled to a lien, then this court would have before it and does have before it that conflict of laws issue, because that determination has to be made and has been fully briefed by the parties.
Thank you.
Thank
Any
you.
Other questions?
I do have a question, and I apologize. I know we're mm-hmm. over time, if that's okay, Chief.
Yes, of course.
My recollection is that within the appellate appendix, there's a written order from the Arizona Industrial Commission that I assume was an inquiry from appellate about the Arizona Industrial Commission weighing in on this issue of whether she was entitled to keep Copper Point from accessing the medical malpractice settlement funds. And the Arizona Commission, a couple of months, I think, after the district court order, issued an opinion saying they were entitled to do that. So my question is, what's the status of that? Because I believe it went up on appeal to the Arizona Court of Appeals. And does that in any way implicate the jurisdiction of the below court here in ruling on that issue?
Thank you for raising that. There was a request by respondent that this court take judicial notice of the decision, the unpublished memorandum decision of the Arizona Court of Appeals on that matter. However, a petition for review was timely filed with the Arizona Supreme Court, and therefore, although there was a decision by the administrative law judge and there was an unpublished memorandum opinion affirming that, it is now before the Arizona Supreme Court, and the decision is not a final decision. Okay. And so as we are here today, it has no effect.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Hooks, how are you today?
I'm very well, Justice Hardesty. And may it please the court, thank you very much. Dalton Hooks on behalf of respondent Copper Point. You've asked us to address three questions today in the docketing statement, and I'm going to kind of follow that. You've intimated a question that you want me to answer, and I will answer that as well.
Sure.
But when you first asked us, the three questions are whether the district court had subject matter jurisdiction over this matter, if the appellant's claims were subject to the exclusive jurisdiction of the Arizona workers' compensation system. The second is, if the district court has jurisdiction, does 42021 apply to settlements? The third, if it does apply to settlements, what is Arizona's interest in terms of conflict? And so it's starting with that first question, and I think it is, as has been briefed, and as the court below said, it's dispositive. We believe that the answer is emphatically no, and that's for three reasons. Firstly, a lack of subject matter jurisdiction appears on the face of the pleadings in this matter. Next, both Arizona and Nevada have workers' compensation acts which provide exclusive administrative remedies and limited judicial review of determinations made through that administrative process. And lastly, the appellant hasn't exhausted his administrative remedies. And I address that very quickly, based on the questions that you asked, Justice. It is still working through the Arizona workers' compensation system. But turning to the lack of subject matter jurisdiction that appears on the face, as we briefed, the Grillo case notes that a motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction is proper where a lack of jurisdiction over the subject matter appears on the face of the pleading. In this case, the pleading is the complaint. And that's page 32 of our answering brief. In the complaint, which is at the joint appendix pages 1 through 22, the claimant seeks both declaratory and injunctive relief, which you referred to, Justice, and the record itself, it speaks for itself. The record is literally replete with examples of pleas for relief that turn on questions that are properly addressed in the workers' compensation system. I think the question was asked of the appellant, why are you here? And the question put back was, well, where else are we supposed to be? And the answer to that question is very clearly in the Arizona workers' comp system, perfecting those rights.
So here's my concern, Mr. Hooks. I find it interesting that one would argue that the Nevada courts would not have subject matter jurisdiction to interpret a Nevada statute concerning whether that statute permits a right of subrogation against a personal injury recovery, whether by verdict or settlement, in a medical malpractice action. So your argument, in effect, from a pragmatic standpoint, has this court deferring to an administrative law judge, an Arizona Court of Appeals, and the Arizona Supreme Court to determine for Nevada citizens how we interpret this statute.
Thank you.
That seems problematic to me.
I understand, Justice, and I think that that's a matter of framing.
Well, that's true. How you write the question is...
I don't mean on your part, Justice.
No, I understand.
Yeah. What I mean to say is this. That would be true if what was being presented to you was a case that concerned either medical malpractice or another issue of tort, but it isn't. What you have here...
Well, let me add one more thing, because the accountant in me compels to ask this question, even though it's probably not germane to any of this. But if I recall, if my understanding is correct, the settlement here was around $6 million, something like that.
Yes, sir.
And that the lien or subrogation request, at least to this point, is $3 million.
Yes, sir.
But my experience in these cases is that the workers' compensation payments would not likely cover all of the things that would be normally requested in a medical malpractice case.
That's correct.
So the $6 million would likely cover more than your lien, but it might also cover less than your lien. And I don't know that that has been raised either. And I don't know whether allocating this or parsing it out is even appropriate given the way the questions are currently sitting here in front of us.
I think I can answer that question for you.
Thank you.
It moves into what would be my second argument, which is concerning the authority upon which counsel relies, which piggybacks off of the California Code, the 3333.1. Mm-hmm. In saying that settlements, despite the plain language of the Nevada statute, if we're talking about 42.021, there is a condition precedent to being barred from introducing or to being able to pursue the lien. And that is that the defendant decides to introduce evidence of the lien at trial.
Mm-hmm.
That condition precedent doesn't exist here. What counsel wants you to do is to simply adopt the California interpretation of it, and there's a couple of reasons why you shouldn't do that. First, we're in the Silver State, not the Golden State, number one. Number two, the laws upon which, the decisions upon which counsel relies are factually very distinctly different and in material ways. Both cases deal with California workers' compensation cases being pursued by the collateral source trying to perfect a lien or get a lien or an offset. What they call in California a credit, we would call here in Nevada an offset per chem.
So under your analysis, if I could just interrupt you with this extension of what I understand your argument is. If this case had gone to trial and the plaintiff had elected not to introduce the workers' compensation costs that are being reimbursed here, but instead only introduced that evidence which supported the medical malpractice claim that for costs incurred in Nevada and for non-economic recovery, you wouldn't have the right to assert a subrogation lien?
No, I'm saying that I would. Part of that, Judge, is because...
So you'd have a right to assert a subrogation lien for amounts that were not sought by the plaintiff in the Nevada case. Is that what you're saying?
That seems... We would have in Nevada, and this is one of the problems with trying to tie this into California law, we cannot in Nevada separate the application of 42021 from the act which in 61...
Maybe my question wasn't clear. Let's say for a moment that either the plaintiff in the Nevada malpractice action introduces in support of its claim to a Nevada jury, setting aside the question of settlement versus trial, just those damages associated with the amounts incurred in Nevada, doesn't introduce any of the costs that workers' compensation is reimbursed. And according to the Nevada statute, there's no right to subrogation for those amounts, at least for the Nevada claims. Would you still have a right to subrogate against that verdict?
Yes, Your Honor, because of the application of NRS 6166C under the Nevada Industrial Insurance Act 215. 616C215 gives me the ability to do that as defending a work comp carrier in subrogation. We have a right of subrogation. In fact, before the statutes changed, we used to have a right of intervention. It wasn't even a permissive. We were able to intervene in those cases and to present our costs, and we can still do that, but it's the leave of the court now.
So under the hypothetical I pose, the Arizona Workers' Compensation Insurance Company would be able to resort to the Nevada Workers' Compensation Statute as a vehicle to secure subrogation against a verdict that never included any of the Arizona compensation costs.
I think that's
what I hear you saying.
I think that's a slightly different question, Judge, but it gets to the point that I was going to make earlier with regard to the interpretation of the California statute.
Okay.
Stop
interrupting you.
It's okay. The California statute, or the California decisions, Brahmi and mm-hmm. Graham, both turn on cases where it is the collateral source who is trying to assert the lien. That's not the presentation here. And importantly, in both of those cases which deal with applying that law to settlements, there were settlement documents, or the courts indicated, for example, in Graham, that the parties had introduced sufficient evidence that the defendant was going to introduce evidence of the work comp payments. In the one case, you have a written document that states it, and in the other, the court said that there is sufficient.
Well, it's those cases that motivated my question.
And
because in a settlement, unless you have that kind of breakdown, you're not sure whether or not the workers' comp, whether it's from another jurisdiction or this jurisdiction, was tendered in support of the effort to secure the settlement.
But we do in this underlying case.
Okay.
Page 185 of the joint appendix. Okay. We actually have the language, and the court below noted this, but wasn't very specific about it. He said they attempted to perfect that, and then goes on to say that he doesn't have jurisdiction for other reasons. Mm-hmm. But I will point you to paragraph 10 of the settlement agreement below. And what it says, it actually cites to NRS 42021. And it says, I'll read it, as allowed by the court and above described, defendants introduced evidence of plaintiff's health insurance. There is no mention of workers' comp at any time. So even if you were going, my client is the employer's work comp carrier. It is expressly omitted from this paragraph. And so even under the analysis that is given by the two California courts, that analysis would not apply to the facts here because it's materially different. In both of those cases, they said it's just like our law. There's a condition precedent. The defendant must introduce the evidence. And if this defendant does so, plaintiff can introduce evidence of payment, because the whole point of this is to keep juries from getting confused. We don't have to worry about that confusion if we're looking at it in Nevada, because 216C215 gives you a jury instruction that explains you're going to hear this and you're still going to ignore the fact that there was workers' comp. You're going to give them all of the money. And that is designed to make sure that the jury isn't confused and to give effect to the subrogation right that work comp carriers in Nevada have. And so the reason that you shouldn't consider the analysis from Graham or the Brahmi case is they are materially different in both procedure, how they got there, and what was the evidence that the court was looking at. I would presume, based on those decisions, that had there not been evidence of the collateral source introduced via these provisions or whatever the evidence was they found in Graham, that the court wouldn't have done so because it is a condition precedent to do it. The collateral source isn't blocked unless that evidence is introduced. Is that responsive, Judge? Justice, I'm sorry.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. The other reason, as my time is running low now, you shouldn't implicate 42021 is because it would render, as we briefed, NRS 616C215 nugatory. And there's no reason to do that. It would also affect the public policy avoiding double recovery, which is expressed in the Chandler decision, which is the law that we work comp lawyers use. We have an offset even if we don't proceed it because it comes from Chandler. Also, predictability. One of the things that's important about this, again, looking at the complaint itself, paragraph 37 of the complaint, again, roughly pages 1 through 21 of the joint appendix, in their plea concerning the underlying legal malpractice, the appellants note that Nevada attorneys, one of the faults that they find with claimant's counsel or the Ms. Harper's counsel is that Nevada attorneys representing plaintiffs in medical malpractice cases do not ignore workers' compensation liens or advise their clients that such liens should be ignored. And that's a fact. I'm a Nevada workers' comp lawyer. That's what I do. I am bar certified expert in workers' comp here. We don't do that because the lien is not extinguished. It does exist. I'm out of time.
I'm going to give you 2 minutes because of my interruptions, and then I'll add 2 minutes to counsel's time.
I appreciate it, Justice. Thank you. So this is not part of what we do. No Nevada attorney who practices workers' comp in this state would suggest to someone that a work comp lien does not exist on malpractice cases because that isn't the way the law is interpreted. Beyond that,
by talking about the conflicts question?
Yes, sir. Thank you. So with regard to the conflicts, relying on a case that I think you were involved in, Your Honor, the Clink case, Tri-County Equipment. Mm-hmm. We don't undertake a conflict of law analysis unless there's a conflict of law. And so the question presented in that, I believe, is, well, what would happen if this was, because it is a Nevada workers' compensation case, and we were evaluating it under Nevada law? The result would be, in my view, the exact same if you applied 42021 plus, because you must, NRS 616C215, because that gives full effect to the system.
If I can interrupt, yes, in regard to 42021, sections 1 and 2, do you draw any distinction in those as to whether they're evidentiary or substantive, or one is one and the other is another?
Well, I think that's an important question. And the answer, I think, is complicated. At least it is for me. Because this isn't being presented to you as an evidentiary question. You're not evaluating whether evidence of collateral evidence can come in. What you really are addressing here is an attempt to do a kind of an end run around the Arizona workers' compensation and get a declaration that the lien is invalid, and therefore you can't suspend our benefits, you can't get the lien back, and you must pay, which is the result of the demand that you have for relief. It is the majority of the relief that is being thought on this complaint is to have the Nevada court tell effectively the Arizona workers' compensation system how the claim should be administered. And that is the problem. It is the way it is being presented. If we were here talking about an evidentiary question as to whether something should come in or not, which is what the statute is intended for, I think that would be the right analysis. But again, to this conflict issue, there is no conflict. The same result would happen in terms of whether the lien would still exist under a Nevada workers' compensation analysis. And just the last point about that, and that is because you apply 42021, you see that including the fact that there was no time at which an action was taken by a defendant to introduce the evidence into court of the lien or any payments regarding it, that subparagraph 2 is not activated. There's a condition precedent that didn't happen. And so the same would be true in Arizona. So there is no conflict between what would happen under a Nevada workers' compensation / subrogation analysis or an Arizona one. The only thing that would happen is if you strip out, pretend that the Nevada Industrial Insurance Act doesn't exist and 616C215 is rendered nugatory, then you can get to the result that the appellant wants, which is for you to quash the lien so that they can affect the benefits. And so to that point, as the Arizona Supreme Court said in the decision that we cited, workers' comp benefits are substantive. And what the appellant seeks to do is to obtain substantive rights under the Arizona workers' compensation system through alleging that there's an evidentiary problem in Nevada that invalidates a lien, but it's a substantive attack on rights and responsibilities under the Arizona Workers' Compensation Act. If there aren't any questions, I'll rest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for granting me 2 more minutes. Counsel for respondent takes the position that there is no condition precedent. And in doing so, what he is actually advocating is charade trials, that in order to comply with the precise words of 42.021, there has to be evidence introduced at a trial. If that is true, and if this court holds that that is the requirement, then I submit it would be legal malpractice for any plaintiff's lawyer to enter into a settlement in a medical malpractice case that didn't require what I will call a charade trial. that they agree on the terms of the settlement subject to the introduction of evidence during a trial. And so the parties would go into the trial court, they would start the trial, they would stipulate that the evidence has been offered and admitted, and then they would tell the judge, okay, we're done here, Your Honor, because now we've satisfied the statute. That would be absurd, and that would be a required charade that all lawyers would have to engage in order to get the benefit of the lien preclusion. The second issue has to do with whether, if Copper Point had been a party
before
in
you go
the Nevada...
Beyond that, before you go beyond that, let's just take up that point and extend it one step further, because it kind of plays into what Mr. Hooks has argued. Does a Nevada workers' compensation carrier have the benefit of 617, 619, whatever that statute number is? And if so, does a foreign workers' compensation insurance company have the benefit of that statute in the case of a settlement?
I was about to address the first part of that question, Your Honor.
I'd like you to address both.
The first part of the question is that a respondent is advocating that workers' compensation insurance companies are not bound by 42.021, even though 42.021...
I don't hear his argument that way. What I hear his argument to be is, because of the workers' compensation statute in Nevada, this carrier, an Arizona carrier, gets to make a claim under that statute in the case of a settlement for the reimbursement of the workers' compensation advancement.
Yes, that's what he is arguing.
That's right. So my question is, does an Arizona carrier get the opportunity to take advantage of a Nevada statute for their subrogation rights?
I think the answer to that is no, because the law, the workers' compensation law in Nevada is for Nevada workers' compensation cases. This is not a Nevada workers' compensation case. It was an Arizona workers' compensation case, and you can't mix and match by saying that we're going to give rights, because they're saying that they have rights based on Arizona law. Now they're saying that they have rights based on Nevada workers' compensation law, and we disagree with that. Mm-hmm. In fact, we advocate the position that there is no carve-out under the Nevada Workers' Compensation Act for two reasons. Number one, there was the workers' compensation action was not in Nevada. And second, under statutory construction rules, a statute that is more specific than a general statute will be held to be the prevailing statute. 42.021 specifically says, in no medical malpractice case shall there be a lien by the source of collateral benefits. The workers' compensation law to which Mr. Hooks refers says that there is a lien in general. So he is advocating that 42.021 doesn't even apply to workers' compensation. And I believe that there is disarray in the understanding of law in Nevada, because there is this confusion. Is there a lien if it's workers' compensation under the workers' compensation statute, or is there no lien under the specific terms? And so to the extent that there is confusion, this court, I think, has before it another issue to deal with, and that is the application of that law. And if the court will give me 30 more seconds, if Copper Point had been a party to this litigation as a subrogor, and the case had gone to trial, there'd been a verdict for the plaintiff, Would Copper Point be bound as a party before the court to the fact that there is no lien? Or did they get to be treated special? Well, sure, we know we were a party here. We know we asserted lien rights and subrogation rights here, but we're from Arizona, and we have special rights that no other insurance company has in the state of Nevada. And we submit that that simply cannot be the law.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Bloomberg. Mr. Oaks, thank you very much. One of the privileges of serving on the Supreme Court is hearing outstanding arguments from excellent lawyers. Thank you very much for your contribution to this case. Bill stands.